headlines this hour. Civilians are being evacuated to Russia from eastern Ukraine's self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic as tensions escalate in the rest of the region. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urges Arab and Muslim nations to defend the occupied city of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israel's aggression. Plus, Iran urges the European side in the Vienna talks to consider Tehran's red lines and to avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The situation remains tense in eastern Ukraine amid renewed fighting between government troops and pro-Russia forces. Ukraine's military says pro-Russia forces have opened fire on more than 20 settlements and have killed a soldier. Explosions have also been reported north of Donetsk City. A second exploded shell has been found on Russian territory near the Ukraine border. A leader of pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine has ordered a full troop mobilization over fears of an offensive.
We should unite all our efforts. I call on my fellow countrymen, reservists, to report to mobilization officers. Today I have signed a decree on general mobilization. I call on all men in the Republic able to hold a weapon in their hands to stand up to protect your families, your children, wives and mothers. Together we will achieve the desired and necessary victory for us all. We will protect Donbass and all Russian people.
Pro-Russia forces in eastern Ukraine are continuing to evacuate residents of Donetsk and surrounding areas as several buses were seen leaving for Russia. The situation escalated a few days ago when both sides accused each other of violating a 2015 ceasefire. Russia has expressed concerns over the renewed clashes, describing the situation as potentially very dangerous. Moscow also denies Western accusations that it is planning an invasion of Ukraine. A U.S. official says more than 40% of Russian forces on the Ukraine border are in an attack position and that Moscow has begun a campaign of destabilization. Meanwhile, the U.S. has threatened Russia with what it calls unprecedented economic costs if it invades Ukraine.
And let me be clear. I can say with absolute certainty, if Russia further invades Ukraine, the United States, together with our allies and partners, will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs. We have worked intensively with many of you in this room to ensure we are prepared to move forward with consequences. We have prepared together economic measures that will be swift, severe, and united.
Harris made the announcement on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. She added the U.S. will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries. The U.S. Vice President said, however, Washington will not stop with economic measures. The U.S. and its allies will reinforce natural allies on Ukraine's eastern flank, too. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the U.S. are on high alert. As the West threatens to sanction Russia in case of an invasion on Ukraine, Kiev says imposing restrictions on Moscow after an attack would be too late. The Ukrainian president expressed hope that his country is not seen as a convenient buffer between Russia and the West. Volodymyr Zelensky asked NATO members to be honest about whether they want Ukraine to join. He also stressed that if Russia attacks, Ukrainians will defend their country with or without the help of their allies. Zelensky, however, said Ukraine wants peace and is ready to engage with Russia on any platform. We have asked our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes what European lawmakers make of the flare-up of tensions between Russia and the West. This is what he said.
It's more or less the same line that the West has been pushing in recent weeks since this sort of crisis escalated. And what basically the European Union, the United States and the UK are saying is that Russia will effectively be cut off from the international financial system if there is an invasion of Ukraine. So, and it's that when we heard the debate being debated in the European Parliament, there were a sizable number of MEPs, members of the European Parliament, lawmakers, who were saying that this is just the wrong track to go down, that this constant anti-Russia rhetoric, which we've been seeing building up now for years and years, and these constant threats about the SWIFT system, which is, you know, effectively the international trading and currency system, to cut Russia off from SWIFT and so on. And it's the type of rhetoric that really has been unhelpful, according to many lawmakers. So we've seen an escalation in the threats. We've seen the likes of Joe Biden talking about making sure that the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project between Russia and Germany, that just will be scrapped if there's an invasion of Ukraine.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is urging Arab and Muslim nations to shoulder their joint responsibility to defend the city of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israeli aggression. In a statement marking the World Quds Week, the movement says the occasion is the best opportunity to keep the Palestinian cause alive at an international level. Hamas says that all political and media forums should be utilized to attain that end. The movement has praised the Palestinian nation's struggles to defend Al-Quds against Israeli atrocities, as well as acts of terror by settlers. The statement comes amid heightened tensions in an East Al-Quds neighborhood. Israel has been trying to evict Palestinian families forcibly from Sheikh Jarrah in favor of settlers. The correspondent Mona Kandil joins us from occupied Ramallah, and we have James Thring, who's a peace advocate and political analyst, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Mona Kandil, over to you. We have heard what Hamas has said. This comes at a very good time, I'm thinking, because of the fact that you have the tensions that have always been there, but in particular, for example, Sheikh Jarrah and the evictions that are happening there, along with settler-related news. Tell us more about this statement coming from Hamas and what it expects other Arab nations to do.
Well, for the Palestinians, let's say it could be an opportunity to remind the world and the Muslim world as well about the crisis of the Palestinians in general and those living in Al-Quds, the issue of the Palestinians, the residents of Sheikh Jarrah. The Hamas movement statement had, let's say, called for an active attendance for such events, calling on the Arab and Muslim worlds, as well as the Palestinians living all across the occupied territories, to take part in the events and the activities, especially that the International Quds Week would last for a week. There would be numerous events globally and here in the occupied territories, of course. Hamas movement hailed this initiative and said that no one must forget about the crisis of the residents of Sheikh Jarrah. It's a time when the Israeli regime is supporting the Israeli settlers, trying to give them the green light to bring out Palestinians from their homes, from their lands, from their neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, and to give these Palestinians homes to the settlers. This is, of course, illegal. And that's why all Palestinians and all their friends around the world must gather together in order to protect the residents of Sheikh Jarrah and the Palestinians in general.
James Thring, when you take a look at what has happened with the occupied territories, with the no longer a new president, Joe Biden, in office, we don't hear barely anything coming out of the White House when it comes to Israel and the occupied territories. Why is there such a shift, which it appears to be, from the previous administration, which was which covered Israel-Palestine issue at length, of course, to the dismay of Palestinians? What strategy do you think the U.S. has here?
I don't think it's a strategy of the U.S. I think it's a strategy of the Zionist forces behind the scenes in the U.S. They have always been battling secretly amongst the congressmen and senators, and of course now they've got particularly strong access to the president to make him ignore the Palestinian cause, ignore what the Israelis are doing as their crimes against the Palestinians, and concentrate on Russia and the Ukraine instead, and things like that. And of course, nobody makes the comparison between the complaints about Russia taking what is actually their country back and the Palestinians holding on to their country whilst the Zionists try to steal more of it against international law.
Indeed.
I mean, that's surely a much more serious international problem than what's going on in Eastern Europe.
Okay, so we heard some views there online. Mona Kandil, we have seen what has happened in Sheikh Jarrah, and we know the tensions have been rather severe there, and it's quite incredible when you think of the fact that we're only in February of this year, and so much has happened already. So this call for Al-Quds Week, or that has been called by Hamas, comes at a good time. Have you had any chance to listen to any reactions or hear any reactions from Palestinians?
Well, of course, Palestinians welcome any calls to from the world and even from the different political powers to remind the world about the issue of the Sheikh Jarrah and the issue of Al-Quds in general. We have to say that tensions heightened across the occupied territories and mainly in Sheikh Jarrah when far right-wing Israeli lawmaker, Israeli Knesset member Ben Gavir raided the Sheikh Jarrah with settlers, threatening to open an office there in order to protect the settlers. So the global Quds Week would be an opportunity to bring more support to the Palestinians, to send a message to the Israelis, of course, that the Palestinians are not left alone. At least there would be different activities, different events taking place. People are saying no for the Israeli occupation and rejection for the Israeli policy. This would comfort the Palestinians in a way or another. Of course, there would be some protests and demonstrations might be taking place.
James Swain, quickly, if you can, the social media reactions that we just covered kind of reflect the general sentiment. And one of the ones that stood out is how Palestinians are systematically being treated as inferior, wherein, as you mentioned, it's their land. Give us some examples of how that is happening, and of course, that probably entails breaking international law.
Well, it's not just that they're being treated as inferior; they're being treated worse than. I don't want to say it. I mean, they're being treated inhumanely by people who have no sympathy for other people. It's written into their Talmud, written into their Torah. They regard everyone else, and the Palestinians, unfortunately, at the front line of this, as expendable people. And it's a disgrace, both to the Judaic fraternity that they're sponsoring and allowing this kind of abuse and crime, as well as to the international community. And I could, in answer to your question, cite examples of the crimes against the Palestinians. I've written a whole booklet on it, and I've tried to get action taken, but it's very difficult. The International Criminal Court is trying to pursue the administration in what is now Jerusalem, but should be in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And it's signally failing, it seems to me.
Okay, thank you very much for that. James Thring, peace advocate and political analyst from London, and from Occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, our correspondent there. Thank you so much for both of you. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. The Iranian president says any Vienna deal must entail the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and credible guarantees. This as intensive talks are underway in the Austrian capital aimed at reviving the 2015 agreement. Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. He said Iran continues the negotiations with seriousness and has offered constructive proposals. The president noted that Tehran has assessed the proposals put forward by the other sides based on their conformity with the interests of the Iranian nation. Raisi also warned against any anti-Iran political pressures or claims that he believes could weaken the prospects of reaching an agreement. Macron also spoke of good progress in the talks, expressing hope that the negotiations will yield results soon. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore the agreement, which has been left in a limbo following the U.S. withdrawal. Tehran wants verifiable removal of the sanctions that the U.S. imposed ever since it withdrew from the deal back in 2018. Tehran says the behavior of the U.S. and the European parties to the deal determines how long the Vienna negotiations will last. The Iranian foreign minister has also urged the European sides to play by the rules of negotiation if they want the Vienna talks to yield results. Hossein Amir Abdollahian reiterated that Iran is determined to reach a good agreement as soon as possible. He made the remarks during a meeting with his Italian counterpart on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. The Iranian official also warned the European parties to the JCPOA against making any miscalculations. He urged them to consider Tehran's red lines and to avoid using media hype to sway the negotiations. Fuad Azadi, professor of international studies at the University of Tehran, says the Europeans are spreading propaganda about the Vienna talks to get concessions from Iran.
As we get closer to the end of negotiations and JCPOA, you're going to see these type of tactics. The idea behind this particular tactic is that if you say that we are reaching an agreement, that puts pressure on the other side to accept your proposals, because the general feeling is that an agreement is very near. And that's a way of getting concessions from the other side. So that's one aspect of this story. The second aspect is called the blame game, which is designed to put the responsibility for the failure of the negotiations on the other side, saying that it was the demands that Iran made that resulted in not reaching an agreement. That's what they call them. They talk about the blame game. That's another tactic that's going to be used.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
All those trillions of dollars consumed in wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A pessimism spawned by corporate elites increasingly consumed by greed, says William Astore, a writer, in an article published under the heading 60 Years of War-Making May Yet Result in the Destruction of U.S. Democracy. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Speaking of George Orwell, America's 60-year war, a losing proposition for the many, proved a distinctly winning one for the few, and that wasn't an accident either. In his book Within a Book in 1984, Orwell wrote all too accurately of permanent war as a calculated way of consuming the products of modern capitalism without generating a higher standard of living for its workers. That, of course, is the definition of win-win situation for the owners. In his words, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the stratosphere or sinking in the depth of the sea materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Even when weapons of war are not actually destroyed, their manufacture is still a convenient way of expending labor power without producing anything that can be consumed by the workers. War was a way of making huge sums of money for a few at the expense of the many, who would be left in a state where they simply couldn't fight back or take power. Ever. Think of such war production and war making as a legalized form of theft, as Icke recognized in 1953 in his Cross of Iron speech against militarism. The production of weaponry he declared 8 years before he named the military-industrial complex in the U.S. constituted theft from those seeking a better education, affordable health care, safer roads, or indeed any of the fruits of a healthy democracy, attuned to the needs of its workers. And war was also a way to stimulate the economy without stimulating hopes and dreams, a way to create wealth for the few while destroying it for the many. Domestically, the Vietnam War crippled Lyndon Johnson's plans for the Great Society. The high cost of the failed war and of Pentagon budgets that continue to rise today regardless of results are now cited as arguments against Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's new ideal, arguably, would have never been funded if today's vast military-industrial complex, or even the one in Icke's day, had existed in 1930s. As political theorist Crane Brinton noted in The Anatomy of Revolution, a healthy and growing middle class, equal parts optimistic and opportunistic, is likely to be open to progressive, even revolutionary ideas. But a stagnant, shrinking, or slipping middle class is likely to prove politically reactionary as pessimism replaces optimism and protectionism replaces opportunity. In this sense, the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House was anything but a mystery and the possibility of an autocratic future no less so. All those trillions of dollars consumed in the wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A sign of it is the near total absence of the very idea of peace as a shared possibility for the U.S. Most Americans simply take it for granted that war or threats of war having a defined immediate past will define the future as well. As a result, soaring military budgets are seen not as aberrations, nor even as burdensome, but as unavoidable, even desirable, a sign of national seriousness and global material superiority. It should be mind-blowing that despite the wealth being created and often destroyed by the United States and impressive gains in worker productivity, the standard of living for workers hasn't increased significantly since the early 1970s. One thing is certain. It hasn't happened by accident. For those who profit most from it, America's 60-year war has indeed been a resounding success, even if also a colossal failure when it comes to worker prosperity or democracy. This really shouldn't surprise us. As former President James Madison warned Americans so long ago, no nation can protect its freedoms amid constant warfare. Democracies don't die in darkness. They die in and from war. In case you hadn't noticed, evidence of the approaching death of American democracy is all around Americans. It's why so many of Americans are profoundly uneasy. They are, after all, living in a strange new world, worse than that of their parents and grandparents, one whose horizons continue to contract while hope contracts with them. And here's what worries most of all. America's very long war of destruction against relatively weak countries and peoples may be over, or at least reduced to the odd moment of hostilities. But America's leaders, no matter the party, now seem to favor a new Cold War against China and now Russia. Incredibly, the old Cold War produced a win that was so sweet yet so fleeting that it seems to require a massive do-over. Promoting war may have worked well for the military-industrial complex when the enemy was thousands of miles away with no capacity for hitting the homeland. If a war with China or Russia or both comes to pass, it won't be a long one. And count on one thing. America's leaders, corporate, military, and political won't be able to shrug off the losses by looking at positive balance sheets and profit margins at weapons factories.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Mali's government recently expelled France's ambassador, the latest sign of mounting tensions between the West African country and its former colonial power. The move came after outrageous remarks by French Foreign Minister who claimed that Mali's government is out of control and illegitimate. Now, Mali's foreign minister, Abdoulaye Diop, appeared on the country's national TV to announce the expulsion of the French ambassador.
French ambassador Joël Meyer has not been declared persona non grata, but the government of Mali wished for him to leave the territory within 72 hours for reasons related to the outrageous statements that were made against the transitional authorities, which we found unacceptable and which we have rejected.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the expulsion of France's ambassador to Mali amid worsening ties between the two countries. Tensions have been building up between the two sides as Mali seeks to assert its independence while France is desperate to maintain its grip on its former colony. In the second part of our program, we'll have a guest here in the studio who will be telling us more about increased trade ties between Iran and African countries. So stay tuned with us until the end of our show.
France unwanted in Mali. France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to its neo-colonial influence in this country and the whole region. The major reason for this move is the undiplomatic, insulting remarks by French authorities towards a new military government in Mali. The root of the current tensions goes back to 2012 when France deployed its forces in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali to allegedly fight militants and terrorists. Years after this deployment, terrorists continue to wreak havoc in the country, leaving thousands dead and over a million displaced. This growing insecurity has turned the public opinion massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital Bamako think France sent troops in the country to protect its economic interests. Most people in Mali are strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador and are also demanding now the withdrawal of French troops. Now, for an incisive analysis on the worsening tensions between France and Mali, we contacted Moussa Traoré, a Malian academic and political analyst who is also the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, France has, over the last few months, been brazenly interfering in Mali's internal affairs. Mr. Traoré, was the expulsion of France's ambassador long overdue?
I think this is something that the people of Mali were expecting for a long time. They were even asking themselves questions about why the Malian government, those in power, were not reacting. So, in fact, it seems that the president and the prime minister of Mali just did what the people were asking. And this has been the case since the second coup. If you analyze it, each move that was made by the government was made because the people were asking it.
Over the past few months, French officials made a series of outrageous and hostile comments about Mali's transitional government. The government in Bamako remained patient, hoping the leaders in Paris would get back to their senses, but the following remarks by France's foreign minister angered Malian authorities, leading to the expulsion of the ambassador. Let's take a listen.
It's a new sign of recklessness. This junta is illegitimate and it's taking irresponsible measures.
After those insulting remarks, this was the immediate reaction of Mali's foreign minister.
Insults aren't proof of greatness. We are willing to discuss with France or others on serious matters. This isn't about being irresponsible. What we are trying to do is defend the interests of our country.
Over the years, France has backed and collaborated with military rulers in Africa, so why are the authorities in France hostile to the current leadership in Mali?
Here there is a double standard. If we analyze it. And the reason why this time the French do not accept the fact that we have the military in power is because the military now is working for the people of Mali. They want to strengthen the power of the military, get more independent, and this is why it's disturbing Paris. Also, the military was able to buy new weapons from the Russians, using the gold they have. What the government did, they went directly to the Russians, saying, okay, we have gold, you just come here, get the gold, in exchange, you give us some brand new weapons. So this is a revolution. If you look at this part of Africa, what usually happens is that they go to see France, and France at the last minute says, no, do not buy them from the Russians or the Americans, just buy it from us. And they give very old equipment to the Malians, to the Africans. This is what most African countries are used to. And this is one fact. The military in most African countries is so weak.
Now, many believe the real reason behind the decision by France to continue risking the lives of its troops in a faraway country is to protect French economic and geostrategic interests, namely its exploitation of gold and uranium mines in the region. Additionally, France has been previously accused of backing Tuareg separatists in Mali. Now, Mr. Traoré, what is really at stake if France loses its neocolonial control over Mali?
If France loses its power in this region of Africa, this is the beginning of the end of the French power. We all know that in France there are no resources, there's no oil. In terms of manufacturing, France is not a big country. In terms of agriculture, the French agriculture relies more on the subsidies from the EU. So it means that that's going to be the end of the French power, and this is going to be very problematic. If we look at the, let's say, welfare state that France represents today, it is because we are exploiting, taking the resources from the African continent and making the Africans from Africa starve. And this is what explains the wealth of France. So this is the end of the French power.
Terrorists and militant groups have gone on a killing spree across in Mali and other parts of the Sahel. Currently, Daesh and Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist groups control large parts of central and northern Mali, yet French forces have been in this region for nearly a decade. During a recent protest to celebrate the expulsion of the French ambassador in Mali, an activist said French troops should also be expelled.
It's an important step in the fight, but the victory must go all the way. The next step must be the departure of French forces, and then we will start the move towards economic and monetary sovereignty.
Mali has witnessed increased terrorist attacks over the last few years, despite the presence of French forces. So what are these French troops really doing in Mali?
In this part of Mali, the French were there just to cause trouble. I'm going to explain myself here. When the Malians first asked the French to come, they were asking for aircraft support and not a ground support. And this is not me saying it. It is the man who was the minister in charge of sending the documents to the French at the time. There is a video. He clearly explains that they were asking for aircraft support. So France came with its men on the ground to better exploit and cause trouble, just because it is this region of Africa is very rich in terms of resources. Now, regarding ISIS and all the terrorist groups, it seems that they are being defeated now since the army took the power after the second coup.
Over the last few years, France has seen its power and influence declining sharply in West Africa. People in the region are especially furious because they believe that the presence of French forces has led to increased insecurity. A demonstrator speaks here during an anti-France protest in Burkina Faso.
France has to leave, together with its weapons. That's it. That's what we want. We don't need the French army.
Mr. Traoré, now do the events in Mali indicate that France is losing its grip on West Africa, a region considered a backyard for Paris for decades?
Definitely, yes, I think that this is the beginning of the end for France. It is the decline of France, and this is part of what some call the big replacement. The big replacement is not only in, let's say, in Europe, but it is also regarding the rich countries, poor countries, and the African continent. Okay, so what I see now, if you exploit people for a long time, if you dominate them in terms of culture, in terms of, let's say, technology, if they learn about your language, if they learn about your technology, if they learn about your culture, and they have the same diplomas as you, but they keep their own tradition, own rules, own knowledge, they are going to be stronger than you. And this is what is happening to France.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Traore, for your insight. No doubt, Africa is rising, and former colonial powers are apparently not ready to face the fact. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, our guest here in the studio will talk about efforts to boost trade between Africa and Iran.
Boosting Iran-Africa trade.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Iran has reported a major surge in non-oil exports to Africa in the 9 months to December 2021. Now, to discuss efforts to boost trade ties between Africa and Iran, we have in our studio today Mr. Mohammed Hashemi Fard, an international trade expert. Now, but before we go to our interview, let's see what the statistics have to say.
Iran's Trade Promotion Organization says Iranian exports to African countries had reached a total of $912 million between March and December last year, up 199% from the similar period in 2020. Iran also plans to encourage more imports from Africa, which remain low at $40 million over the 9 months to late December 2021.
Welcome back, and as I told you, in the studio here, we have Mr. Mohammed Hashemi Fard, an international trade expert. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, first, can you tell us what is the level of trade between Iran and Africa currently?
At the present time, this is not as much as good, and we have a very, very good potential, and we hope to increase our relationship, commercial relationship, and industrial in the different fields between Iran and Africa, because Iran has a very great potential to expand and to develop its relationship with the African countries.
As we heard in the statistics, the trade between Iran and Africa has increased over the last 9 months.
Yes.
Now, what products are being exported to Africa? What is attractive to the African market from Iran?
In different categories, like home appliances, like agricultural machinery and tools, like building materials and constructive materials, like petroleum materials, and also engineering service and human service, which is very, very important to export from Iran to African countries.
Yeah, and according to the statistics which we just heard, the current balance of trade between Iran and Africa is in favor of Iran. So what efforts are there to ensure that there is an exchange from both sides? There's a balance of trade. Iran buys more from Africa just as Iran sells more to Africa.
To make a better balance between Iran and Africa, I think we have to concentrate on what African countries separately have to offer. For example, what Ethiopia has to produce and export is different than Kenya or Tanzania or other countries. We have to list the potential of those countries and to know exactly what we need. For example, some of African countries, they have the oil, but we are exporter of the oil, we cannot import it. But we have to, I think, import the raw material. Raw material and some wood, I think, and agricultural material to use it in Iranian production line in industries.
and meat products, I think, and also coffee and tea also from Africa.
Exactly. We are right now importing the coffee and meats. But about the meats, they have some points that we have to negotiate with the African departments and governments to solve that points to be able to import the meats in different types of the meats from African countries to Iran.
So we expect to see a growth of our products from Africa to Iran in the near future.
Of course.
I think that should be the target.
It is very important, and the Iranian government at the present time has a very good program to increase its relationship and to make it deeper and deeper with the relation between Iran and Africa to develop the relation between Iran and them. But it is based on win-win
situation
between Iran and others.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, several meetings and conferences have been held to discuss business opportunities between Iran and Africa. One such forum was recently held here in Tehran with special focus on boosting trade ties between Iran and the East Africa region. We attended the conference and talked to some of the participants. Let's take a look.
Like we have always said, Iran has great capacities in machinery, technology, which Africa can benefit from. Africa, we have a lot of resources untapped, which Nigeria and African countries can benefit from the experience and expertise and the technology of Iran, both in the mineral resources and in gas and oil and gas sectors. Nigeria and Africa can benefit from Iran. And, you know, Nigeria is a very large country. We have over 200 million people. And Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa. So collaboration between Nigeria and Iran will boost development in the two countries. We learn from Iran. Iran can invest in Nigeria, and Nigerian investors can also come to Iran and invest, especially in the gas and oil industries.
Iran is one of the main producer of finished products, machinery.
Yeah.
Also, the African businessman can export fruits, raw material, and meat also to Iran. There is many needs for agriculture product and agriculture fruit in Iran. Also, there is a good opportunity for Iranian to go in an area of engineering services in Africa. Africa infrastructure in Africa developing very fast, and many countries invest in infrastructure. That's a good opportunity for Iranian to go out and collaborate with the African in this area.
Welcome back to the studio. We have with us here Mr. Hashim Ifad, an international trade expert, and you're discussing about boosting of trade ties between Iran and Africa. Now, Mr. Hashim Ifad, as we know, compared to other regional powers who have a presence in Africa, such as Turkey and India, Iran has much more to offer, yet its presence in Africa is weak. Now, what are you doing to make sure that Iran has a stronger presence in Africa in terms of trade and business?
We have to make a new plan, a new strategy to empower our presence in Africa.
Yeah.
What we have done in Africa before, it was not as great as what we can do.
Yeah.
And at the present time, for your more information, Iran is like a factory for the Middle East and African countries.
Exactly.
So we have to exactly represent our facility, our technology, our power in these countries and this continental, this great continental. Mm-hmm. And the new government of Iran has started to plan for its new presence in the deeper region. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be very, very good for the both sides to have a better presence in African countries, which we will do it, inshallah.
Now, as we know, apart from manufactured goods, Iran has also expertise in engineering services. Yes. And Iran is almost self-sufficient in the engineering services in this country. Now, what efforts are being made to, you know, transfer these expertise to African countries?
In the different types of the engineering, we have the power, we have the technology, and we have the know-how.
Yeah.
This is very important.
Exactly.
Right now, we are not a country which is not able to export its facility, its technology, its knowledge, and its know-how to other countries. Mm-hmm. If we increase our relationship between Iran and Africa, I'm sure, and we are sure, that Iran can cover a very great African projects in the very, very high quality
projects.
And the constructive and the other technical items and projective and in industrial, which is exactly one of the Iranian power. And we have to start to increase our relationship and our presence in this field too.
Now, in terms of technology, Iran has established a House of Innovation and Technology in Nairobi.
Yes.
I mean, this is a very great move. Now, how is this being replicated in other African countries? And do you have a plan to establish more such innovation centers in other African countries? Because I think Africa needs technology now.
At the present time, we have to have a very great look and deep look for the future.
Yeah.
All the future relationship in the market is based on technology, is based on innovation, is based on a strategy which is based on technology and innovation. Mm-hmm. Iran is one of the leader countries in the world which is exactly concentrated on the technology and innovation, and we have opened our showroom and our center in Nairobi for this one and for this purpose, and we can expose and we can introduce our power, our facilities, and our energy and our technology and knowledge and know-how to other African countries via this great center.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Hashim Ifad, for your insight. But unfortunately, our time is up for today. But we'll keep talking about this subject in future, and we shall invite you.
Thank you so much for your invitation.
You're welcome. Now, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. As always, it was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.